Welcome to episode 30. It is April 24th. Hey, that's my brother's birthday. All right, well, anyway, we're going to kick things off talking about the Looney Tunes, and this will be part one of a series where we break down that history. We'll have a trivia question, as always, and then Stephen is going to continue talking about cinematography in his Film Buffs Dictionary series, talking about close-ups, medium shots, and long shots. You may know what those are, but he's going to give us details about how they're used, too. Top six list this week, it's going to be top six ghost movies. Spooky. And wrapping things up, a film spotlight on a Charlie Chaplin movie, Modern Times. A very, very interesting pick and a good movie to look at if you're interested in getting into silent comedy or Charlie Chaplin. Good one to start with. I'm Sam Stoddard.
Shh! Be very quiet, Sam. I'm hunting rabbits. But, I mean, I was going to be hunting wabbits, but some little bald dude beat me to it. Oh yeah, I'm Stephen Keller.
In their heyday, Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies were essentially interchangeable, but in the early days there was a big difference. The Looney Tunes started in 1930 and would feature recurring characters and be done in black and white until 1943. The Merry Melodies started a year later in 1931, and they were prestige pictures, sort of the counterpart to Disney's Silly Symphonies. They were in color right off the bat, mostly featured one-shot characters and would be designed around music, specifically soundtrack music from Warner Brothers films, with the idea that the cartoons would essentially be advertisements for the music. Well, gradually the two series kind of drifted together, especially once the Looney Tunes switched to color as well, although both names continued to be used thereafter. They're basically indistinguishable from each other except by their theme music. So for this week's series spotlight, we'll be treating both series as one series, and of course this is sort of continuing the trilogy on animation that we did several weeks ago. I mentioned before that we'd be filling in the gap here that I left for the Looney Tunes, and so now we're going to do that. So, as far as I can tell, there were exactly 1,000 of these cartoons made between 1930 and 1969 when the cartoon unit was shut down, and since then there have been a bunch of one-off cartoons made as the series gets revived on occasion for special moments, but as the main series was going, as an unbroken thing, 1,000, and those are the ones that count. An astonishing percentage of these are among the greatest cartoons ever made. Some of them, I think, are among the greatest comedies ever made, and they're certainly great works of art, too, but we'll get to that. The first Looney Tune was called Sinkin' in the Bathtub, and as the Merry Melodies would do even more so, one of the reasons for this cartoon was to take advantage of Warner's huge music library, feature a couple of popular songs that they already had the rights to use, and maybe get people humming it on their way out of the theater, and so then, of course, they'd want to buy the song. The main character was called Bosco, and he was the first major Looney Tunes character. We don't know him today, but he appeared in 39 cartoons, most of them sequences of loosely connected musical gags. Like many cartoon stars of his time, he was more or less a variation of Mickey Mouse. We mentioned before how Mickey Mouse spawned a lot of imitators, and you know, you take away the trademark ears and a couple other minor alterations, and then you have a new star. In this case, you had Bosco. But he never really caught on, and to top things off, the animators Hugh Harmon and Rudy Ising had a falling out with the producer, Leon Schlesinger, and they left the studio taking the rights to Bosco with them. So we had to have a new character, a new Looney Tunes character had to be created to fill the void, and that was Buddy, a cute little boy that was even more bland and uninteresting. So in desperation for a marketable character, the director Friz Freleng made the cartoon I Haven't Got a Hat in 1935, which introduced a whole bunch of characters, and the hope was that at least one of these would stick. The odds-on favorite was a character called Beans, who was essentially another Mickey Mouse-esque guy. And then there was Oliver Owl and Little Kitty and a pair of twins called Ham and X. And maybe one you actually recognize, a big guy named Porky Pig. Well, all of these characters went on to star in their own cartoons, especially Beans, because the studio really had their hopes on this character. Why, I don't know. There was nothing distinguishing particularly about him. But obviously it was Porky Pig that caught on, and finally the Looney Tunes had a bankable star. The name Porky Pig actually comes from a couple of childhood friends of Friz Freleng's, one named Porky and one named Piggy. And originally Porky Pig was a big fat kid voiced by Joe Doherty, who actually did have a stutter that he could not control. And you'd think that would work out just fine, because of course Porky Pig very famously stutters, but it didn't, and in 1937, a guy named Mel Blanc won the audition to be Porky Pig's new voice. Now, obviously, Blank would go on to voice virtually every Looney Tunes character, major and minor, throughout the rest of their run until his death in the 80s. It's said that he voiced some 1,000 different characters, and that may be an exaggeration, but maybe not. There are, however, more important exceptions than you might think, because Mel Blanc is essentially the only credited vocal artist on the cartoons, because that was in his contract. He would be the only vocal artist credited there. But, for example, it was Arthur Q. Bryan who voiced Elmer Fudd, and there were a number of other notable exceptions as well. But, anyway, originally Porky Pig was this big fat kid with an inconsistent personality, and it was director Bob Clampett who would mold him into the thinner, more adult character we're familiar with today. And one of the things he's best known for is stuttering "That's all, folks," at the end of the cartoons, whether he was in it or not, but it wasn't originally his line. Before that, Bosco and Buddy and Beans all used the line at the end of their own cartoons. Now, the second big star to come along was Daffy Duck, who originally appeared in a cartoon featuring Porky Pig as a hunter, a role later, you know, of course, normally filled by Elmer Fudd. But Daffy Duck evolved probably more than any other character, because in the first one, and in a lot of the early Daffy Duck cartoons, he was truly Daffy. He was absolute wild, madcap lunatic. He would just hoot and holler and dance and prance around and everything. And that played well off Porky Pig as the straight man. Porky Pig and Elmer Fudd were the two straight men characters in the Looney Tunes. And over time, Daffy's personality evolved to something more rational and greedy, and that worked well as a foil for Bugs Bunny, because Daffy Duck would get uptight and flustered and desperate and dramatic, and Bugs would keep his cool and still emerge victorious. So it's interesting that Daffy Duck was sort of evolved and defined according to the characters he was playing against. And it's also interesting how some characters just spring to life in their final form right off, while others evolve sometimes from other characters. Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd both started out as different characters, Happy Rabbit and Egghead, respectively, and went through a number of changes in appearance before settling into their final forms. On the other hand, characters like Sylvester and Wile E. Coyote and Pepe Le Pew pretty much appeared in their final form right off. Now, I want to talk a little bit about how the animation studio was set up. Originally, it was owned by producer Leon Schlesinger, who really didn't know much about animation or comedy. He didn't understand the humor. In fact, the lisping voices of Daffy Duck and Sylvester were based on Leon Schlesinger's actual voice, and he never seemed to realize that. The animators and directors, everything, they'd screen the first Daffy Duck cartoon or Sylvester or whatever for him, and they'd kind of wonder if he'd catch on, and he'd just turn around and he'd say, "Where did they get such a funny voice?" It just never dawned on him that these characters were based on him, but at least he didn't admit it. But he was an incredibly savvy businessman, and he was apparently a fantastic boss to work for, too, because he knew well enough to keep out of the creative process. He recognized talent, and he hired people like Tex Avery, Bob Clampett, Chuck Jones, and the musical director Carl Stalling, and he got out of their way, sticking to the business side of things and letting the creative team do their thing. His studio was set up right on the Warner Brothers lot. There was the main building with administration and the Merry Melodies units. The prestige pictures, as I say, they would be done in the main building. And then a building out back where the Looney Tunes were produced. And it was so dilapidated that it became nicknamed Termite Terrace. So you may have heard the term. It's a nickname that eventually carried over to the main building as well after the original Termite Terrace was torn down. But, you know, the people moved in there and they're looking around and they think, don't think we're alone in here, because it was riddled with termites and you could see through the floor and all that stuff, so it was called Termite Terrace. Anyway, in 1944, Schlesinger sold everything to Warner Brothers and they started producing the cartoons on their own. And the creative teams basically stayed intact, but the new boss was Eddie Seltzer, and he was apparently a horror to work under. The story that sums up everything with him seems to be that when he was walking by and he heard a bunch of the animators laughing over the storyboard, and so he barged in and said, "What in the hell does all this laughter have to do with the making of animated cartoons?"
And excellent.
And in Chuck Jones's autobiography, he actually said in retrospect, this was probably a good thing because it gave the creative team something to push against. For example, Seltzer would say something like, like, he would just come up and say, you know, camels aren't funny. And, of course, that inspired Friz Freleng to make Sahara Hare, featuring Yosemite Sam's comic attempts to handle this stubborn camel. And Seltzer fought with Freleng about pairing up with Tweety and Sylvester, saying this was a silly idea. And he fought with Chuck Jones over Pepe Le Pew, saying there was nothing funny about a skunk that spoke French. Of course, both of those wound up winning him Oscars for Best Animated Short, that is Tweety and Sylvester and Pepe Le Pew. On one occasion, he said, there's nothing funny about bullfighting, and after he left, Chuck Jones says, well, he hasn't been right yet, and he made Bully for Bugs, the one where Bugs Bunny winds up in a bullfighting ring. Anyway, whether under Schlesinger or Seltzer, the creative team was divided up into a few different units, each headed by a different director. For the most part, each director had his own standard team of artists and animators and painters and everything. And while sometimes animators were shifted around, you can get to know who directed a cartoon before you get to the directorial credit, usually. You just look at the list of animators, and if you know which ones went with this director, you know who directed it before the credit comes up. Other guys like Mel Blanc doing the voices, and Carl Stalling doing the music, and Treg Brown doing the sound effects, they all tended to work across all the different units. But each unit had to produce 10 cartoons a year. 5 weeks for each cartoon and 2 weeks of vacation, so that takes you through a whole year. And a certain number had to be Bugs Bunny cartoons, and a certain number had to be with some of the other big characters like Daffy Duck, and a certain number would feature the director's own characters. For example, Chuck Jones did all the Roadrunner cartoons and all the Pepe Le Pew cartoons, and Robert McKimson did Foghorn Leghorn, and Friz Freleng did most of the Sylvester and Tweety cartoons. Although Sylvester is sort of an oddball because he was used in different ways. Freleng paired Sylvester with Tweety, and Freleng and McKimson jointly paired him with Speedy Gonzales, and McKimson also paired him with Hippity Hopper. That's the kangaroo character that's always bouncing him around. And Chuck Jones would pair him with Porky Pig, so the characters would get used by all the different units, but maybe in different ways. Anyway, the point is that each of the animation units worked under pretty tight deadlines, but there was still room for them to experiment, maybe do a cartoon here and there that didn't feature any of the major star characters. And Chuck Jones discovered that once they got the Roadrunner formula down, they could churn those out pretty quickly. So without telling the administration, as far as they were concerned, all the cartoons took 5 weeks, but without telling them, he and his team would agree and just say, all right, we're going to do a Roadrunner in 3 weeks, and then use 7 weeks to do something more ambitious and complicated like What's Opera Doc and One Froggy Evening, two absolutely wonderful cartoons that took a lot of extra time because of the complicated musical requirements.
I like that.
So let's talk a little bit about these cartoons as works of art, because I really think they are. First and foremost, they are, many of them individually, but certainly as a body of work, they're masterful at accomplishing what they set out to do, which are just absolutely wonderful comedies with great characters that play off each other really well. Creative gags, pitch-perfect timing, and so on. A lot of love and care went into these cartoons from a team of great artists at the top of their game. All this goes without saying. I think I also mentioned before, they didn't make these cartoons for kids. They made them for themselves, and that just in itself tells you how much of themselves they invested in this. They weren't generating a product. They were generating something that they took pride in, and that really comes through, I think. But we should also point out some of the artistry that isn't quite as obvious when you just watch them for fun. For example, the background designs. There were a number of great background artists, in particular Maurice Noble in the Chuck Jones unit. A lot of the backgrounds are wonderful on their own, just as still frames, and yet they're also, and this is more important, just the perfect setting for the action, like the sweeping Arizona landscapes in the Roadrunner cartoons. Those are great examples. Just absolutely wonderful desert backdrops where everything is exaggerated. Horizons and cliffs and tunnels and cactuses and everything. And as the Roadrunner cartoons went on, the backgrounds got more and more stylized and minimalist. Ultimately, actually too minimalist, but great until almost the end of the run. But then you take another cartoon, like Robin Hood Daffy, you know, York's in a way, that one. If you look at the backgrounds there, they are simple, very, very simple, and yet absolutely evocative of some kind of romanticized medieval forest. If you're remembering the cartoon, you might think, oh yeah, that actually had pretty detailed and colorful backgrounds and everything. Watch it again. Actually, it's quite simplistic. A neat thing to look for that you'd never consciously notice if you weren't looking for it is how the backgrounds set off Daffy Duck's green costume. You think in a forest, there's going to be a lot of green around, and he's dressed in green. That's going to cause a conflict with the composition, but actually the backgrounds tend to be a lot more blue and yellow, sometimes not naturally so, but it works seamlessly. And the shapes themselves are quite stylized. Again, the tree trunks are simple, but they're angular. They don't look very realistic. And they're decorated with these intricate leaves that are actually stamped on with a rubber stamp, so not a lot of variation in the leaves and everything. Very, very simple. Not at all in an intuitive way to construct a backdrop, but it does work perfectly because, as I say, as if you remember it, it feels very rich and lush and bright and elaborate and everything. But then there were other cartoons, of course, that had other types of demands, and there was a lot of experimentation that the background artists and directors used to play with different looks. What's Opera Doc, for example, has a lot of rocky spires and proscenium arches and dramatic colors. Duck Dodgers has these incredibly inventive space stations and futuristic machinery. Wakiki Rabbit, which takes place on a tropical island, has these really weird paisley patterns to convey the impression, but not at all the reality, of jungle vegetation. On the other hand, we talked about some elaborate types of things. The 1942 cartoon The Case of the Missing Hare has brilliant backdrops that would never stand alone at all. If you just saw the background, you'd say, oh, you know, I mean, a lot of solid colors, or maybe there's two solid colors with a jagged line division between the two or whatever. It's very strange, but it worked because in this cartoon, most of the action is set on stage, and Bugs Bunny and this magician guy are battling it out during a show. He's trying to do his act, and Bugs is trying to foul it up because this guy wasn't very nice to him earlier on. Well, the backgrounds, as I say, make no sense whatsoever, but what's interesting is about how the backgrounds punctuate the action. Like, if one of the characters smacks another over the head, the background color will actually change right at the point of impact, maybe from blue to green or something, or it'll throb to a different shade and revert. And weird stuff, but it's subliminal. You don't really notice it unless you're looking for it, but it works so well that it really does punctuate the action and kind of heighten it. And so that was really, when you think about it, a very creative idea. And finally, the last thing I want to talk about this week is the music and the sound effects. The music director for the vast majority of the cartoons was Carl Stalling, and he composed or orchestrated the music in most of the cartoons up until 1958. The IMDb actually lists 747 credits to his name. The guy was amazing. I really think that if he hadn't been working on these, they would not have been so enduringly popular. Maybe to an extent. But the music is such an integral part of these cartoons, in some cases more than others, of course. Some are very obviously about music, but even that the others that are not obviously about music depend very much on it. Most of them have distinct musical rhythms to the action, and music is always accompanying the action. The great DVD sets that Warner Brothers has been putting out, the Looney Tunes Golden Collections, do a good job of showcasing this, because many of the cartoons have music-only audio tracks. If you listen to these, or just a couple, or just listen to the regular audio track and listen for the music, it's absolutely everywhere and very, very wonderful. In part because the cartoon studio, which ran on a very tight budget, had access to the regular Warner Brothers orchestra, a full orchestra right at their disposal. Certainly not usually the case with a cartoon studio that didn't have a lot of money. Disney had all the money in the animation scene, but apparently was a lot less fun to work for than the Looney Tunes. But anyway, normally the orchestra was for working on feature films, but when they weren't, the studio still had to pay them, and of course they made the orchestra available to the cartoon studios to get some extra mileage out of them. I need to mention Milt Franklin as well, who's the other major music director. Not quite as many credits as Stalling, but still in the hundreds. Sometimes the two would work together, with Stalling writing original music and Franklin orchestrating it. I think Franklin's shining moment is in arranging and orchestrating Wagner for What's Opera Doc, one of the absolute greatest of the Warner cartoons. Very impressive, because it condenses hours upon hours of Wagner opera into about 6 minutes, and yet still feels authentic and faithful, despite, of course, being a parody. And last in the music and sound crew was Treg Brown, the sound effects man. Usually he's credited as editor, but he wasn't really an editor. For whatever reason, Leon Schlesinger felt that sound effects was an undignified credit to have, so he's listed as editor. And just as these cartoons are loaded with music, they're just also loaded with sound effects. Wile E. Coyote flapping his wings on the bat costume. It might be a memorable example. Or getting tangled in a bow and arrow, with lots of impact sound effects of various kinds, and flapping saw blades and explosions and on and on. He built this huge library of comic sound effects, and sometimes he'd go to crazy lengths to create his own sounds. But anyway, that's a bit about the origins of the Looney Tunes and some of the talent behind them. And over the next 2 weeks, actually, we'll be talking about each of the major directors, and we'll just talk a bit briefly about the seven different ones, because I think that'll shed a lot of light on how much impact a director and his style has, because I think if you think of Looney Tunes, you think of one kind of style, and really there's a bunch of different ones within that. But seven very interesting people, and we'll break it down for you starting next week. Well, since we'll be talking about the Charlie Chaplin film Modern Times a little later on in the show, I figured we'd have a trivia question about the man. And here it is. What was the only competitive Oscar that Charlie Chaplin ever won, and what was unusual about the circumstances? Keep listening, and we'll get to the answer at the end of the show.
One of the most basic elements of film is the shot, and specifically shooting people. And you're going to hear a lot about different ways of shooting people. That's why in today's Film Buffs Dictionary, we're going to talk about the close-up, the medium shot, and the long shot. And all of these are ways of shooting actors. So in other words, filming actors from various distances. And like a lot of terms, there is no hard and fast definition for each one. And you'll hear some arguments about where exactly they fall into. But we're going to give you the general overview. So let's start with probably the most famous of the shots, and that's the close-up. And this is pretty much usually going to be considered just the face and some of the neck of the actors. Sometimes you'll hear an argument that a close-up also includes the top shoulders. Some people or books will refer to this as a medium close shot. It's, I don't want to get into it too much. I don't really care. But just know that if you're looking and the actor's face is filling most of the frame of film, then that's a close-up. And the close-up is interesting because it's one of the truly cinematic inventions. Obviously, it existed before in terms of portraits both being painted and taken photographs of, but this is one of those things that just does not exist on, say, the stage. This is one of the very first cinematic inventions that made movies really distinctly different from stage plays, because you cannot get the sort of intimacy on the stage. You're always looking at the entire body of the actor. You can't ever really get detailed up on the face, especially if, you know, you're sitting back in the cheap seats. You're not going to be able to see an actor's face very well at all at a live show. So the close-up is used a lot in movies to really give us a sense of subtle facial emotions. When you're playing on stage, you have to be a little broader in your expressions. The close-up allowed actors to really refine more subtle means of moving their face to express emotions. Because, of course, in our real lives, when we talk with people, we look them right in the eye. We're standing close to their face, and we can read every little bit of expression that they have. So being able to do this in narratives and film is really helpful. You also see close-ups used a lot to highlight important things. They won't necessarily be of actors. If I want to highlight the fact that there's a knife on the table, as a director, I can just zoom in directly on it, just get a shot of just that knife on the table. And that's, again, something that can't be done easily in other forms of narrative. There's no real analog to the close-up, which is why it's used so much. It's really nice. Without saying anything, without having any character mention something, as a director, I can show that something is important by focusing on just it. It's a really interesting kind of way to do this.
And I've heard it said a number of times that the close-up, the invention of the close-up, is why movies caught on as an art form that people wanted to see, you know, not just art form, but entertainment. Because we cannot get the close-up, as you say, you can't get it in a play, but you don't get the close-up in real life in any form unless you're intimate with someone.
Right.
Really, even if you're just sitting across the table from somebody, that's probably a waist-up shot. It has to be somebody you're very intimate with that you would ever see in real life close to somebody's face and observe their face. And as it turns out, people just love looking at themselves. It's one of these very ingrained thing. You know, we want to look at other people's faces. And the movies have a very unique opportunity, it's voyeuristic really, but it's an opportunity to be close up to somebody that you maybe don't know. And you can observe, and it's also a safe way to observe somebody, because usually if you're looking at somebody in real life up close, they're looking back. But you can, in the movies, go see somebody up close and not be observed yourself, and that's sort of a comforting feeling. It doesn't sound psychologically healthy, but it's certainly appealing to many people, so maybe that's why movies are popular.
Yeah, and it's definitely interesting, and it's such a cinematic thing. Like we said, there's no analog anywhere else. But the close-up has a whole weird sort of mystique about it. One of the things is it forces actors to be particularly good-looking, because every blemish is going to be revealed. Of course, it also means there's a whole litany of secrets that filmmakers use to hide blemishes and that kind of thing when they do close-ups of actors' faces. But actors love the close-up, generally speaking, because it lets them be very subtle. And it also, if you're trying to become famous, you know, it means that people know your face. And I've even heard that there are some actors who will intentionally mutter and mumble their lines when they're not doing close shots to force them in the editing room to use lots and lots of close-ups of that actor. So, and just so we talk a little bit about the way that these are made, is generally speaking, in a movie, you'll do a scene many, many times from a couple of different angles, and then when it's being edited together, the editor and the director, whoever's cutting the film, can take different shots and put them together to make a single scene. Well, and of course, so if you're an actor who is devious and wants a lot of close-ups, you screw up or mumble or make your lines unusable on the long and medium shots, so they have to stick to the close-ups. One other interesting thing, of course, about the close-up is that you have to do it using, generally, a fairly long lens. Really wide lenses, which are used for longer shots. This is, I know it's confusing, a long lens is used for a close shot, a wide lens is used for a long shot. Really wide lenses have pretty good depth of field, which means most things tend to be in focus. However, the downside with using a wide lens is when you get close to things, it distorts the images. If you've ever taken a really wide lens on a camera and gotten right up to somebody taking a picture, it'll make them look absolutely distorted in really strange and subtle ways. So long lenses tend to be used for close-ups, and the other nice thing about doing this is that it means that there's a really narrow depth of field, so just the person's face is in focus. You know, you ever see that, where they focus up on a person's face in a close-up, and the entire background's blurred out? That's because they're using a really long lens with a narrow depth of field. And so that's another interesting thing about close-ups, is it even accentuates that even more. And of course, people look better, generally speaking, on longer lenses, because it doesn't have that weird distortion effect. Well, a medium shot is something between a long shot and a close-up, obviously. And it's going to generally be from either the shoulders up or from about the waist up. And these are sort of more used. These are pretty commonly used when you're, say, cutting together two people talking. So you shoot a lot of medium shots. And this is nice because you can maybe get two people in the frame, whereas a close-up's only going to ever be one person at a time. And you also get to see something more of the background. You're going to probably be using a more medium lens for this, so not everything is all blurred out, and we get a better sense of their environment. And, you know, there's not a lot to say about the medium shot. It's kind of the building block. It's the workhorse. It's not that impressive. You don't really notice it. But it's used a ton. It's probably the most common because it better represents the way we actually see people in real life. And then the long shot is going to generally be the entire body of a character. And so we can get really, really long, you know, to like a helicopter shot of where people just become specks. And it's pretty much everything that's longer than a medium shot. And the nice thing about long shots that they're used especially for when you want to show somebody in an environment, because now you can really see everything around them, and they're not necessarily as singled out. So long shots become really important when you want to situate characters in a specific place, but they're not as intimate at all as medium or close-ups. We don't get the same sense necessarily that we're there, though sometimes you do. If you shoot a bunch of people sitting around talking and they're all completely in frame, all their bodies, that's really kind of like if you're standing around chatting. It makes us seem a bit more like we're there. Obviously, as you get out to really, really long shots, then we're deliberately trying to make the audience seem distant from the characters.
And there's another thing that they talk about objective shots and subjective shots, and what that sort of means is an objective shot means that the audience is observing the facts of a situation, and a long shot tends to be an objective shot. So if you see a bunch of characters in an environment, the audience can see, oh yeah, that person's there and he's doing that thing and this thing is happening and whatever. A close-up tends to be subjective. And that is when our attention as an audience shifts from what is the reality of the situation to what's this character thinking. If you ever want to know what a character's thinking, don't use a long shot. The audience won't be thinking about that. You zoom in on a close-up, and then suddenly our attention is more internal about to the characters. What is this character really thinking? And that sort of psychological effect is very interesting with regard to choosing, well, do I want a long shot here or a medium or a close-up?
It's time for a scary time at All Movie Talk.
And why is it scary? Because we're going to talk about some ghost movies. Anyway, I guess I'm going to kick this off with a classic, and that is Poltergeist from 1982. Subdued and psychological, and it's about a family who lives in a house where everything's not quite normal. Some spooky things going on. It's just, you know, I don't know there's a whole lot to say about it other than it's a really good ghost story. It's a pretty traditional one, the haunted house type genre, but updated for the 80s. And it's a good story.
Yeah, it is a pretty decent movie, which is why it was also my number 6 pick, and I really don't have that much more to say about it. It's a decent flick, kind of fun. Sets up a modern spin on a lot of the older cliches of a ghost movie thing, and does have a few really good scenes. Some of it's a little too cheesy, and it's really a shame, too, that the entire cast died immediately after the film because of the curse.
Yeah, that was terrible. Yeah, you're right. It is very much based on old haunted house traditions, and there were tons of them in the 30s and 40s, haunted house movies. Anyway, my number 5, well, it's from that era, but it's not at all the traditional type. It's called Dead of Night. And if you are very good at remembering what we've talked about in the past on All Movie Talk, you'll remember that this was my favorite film of 1945. It's a British horror anthology, so it's several different short stories strung together in a frame tale kind of situation. Only one of the segments is actually a ghost story, though, so I would have ranked this movie higher maybe if it had more involved with ghosts, but it is a good story, that segment of it. It's played for laughs, actually. Most of the segments are played for scares and frights or whatever, but this one is very humorous and told in that kind of British understatement that's so wonderful sometimes, especially in strange situations like you get into with these people who are ghosts and don't quite know what to make of it.
Yeah, interesting. I haven't seen it, but I do remember you mentioning it before, and I think I said, oh, hey, that sounds interesting. I should watch it, and I still haven't. Well, my number 5 is probably a movie that, like, horror fans would want to kill me for even suggesting, but, you know, I like it a lot, and I'm not ashamed of it, and it's the American remake of The Ring from 2002 by Gore Verbinski, which I think is just a ridiculously effective horror movie. I know there's a sort of backlash against it, maybe, and a lot of people kind of think the Japanese version is superior, but I really, really love the way Verbinski really kind of tones it down. He spends a lot of time just having creepy shots that are inexplicably creepy and frightening, and that to me is a lot weirder than the actual ghost story that goes on, and then kind of that thing with the ghost going around screwing around with people. Just the weird exteriors and weird lighting and wonderful locations. Verbinski, of course, has gone on to direct the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, but I feel like The Ring is just a really strong psychological horror film.
I agree with you, absolutely. That creeped me out, and I like the Japanese version too, but I think there's definitely something to be said about the American remake. He has a number of different things that aren't even in the Japanese version, like that shot of the fly on the... Oh, creepy. Okay, well, anyway. Number 4 for me is A Walk on the Lighter Side. It's The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, which is a romance, actually, with Rex Harrison and Gene Tierney. It's about a woman who goes to live in a cottage by the sea, and it turns out the place is haunted by a ghost that she comes to fall in love with. It's pretty much a romance. George Sanders, now he's a live guy, kind of a heel. He often plays that type of character. He complicates things. You know, he's a smooth operator and everything. And so Rex Harrison, the ghost, gets a bit jealous, but Rex Harrison did another ghost comedy around the same time called Blithe Spirit, which was directed by David Lean. Now, both of these are great. I figured I had to choose between them, though, so I picked The Ghost and Mrs. Muir. But both are very good movies and make a good double feature.
Yeah, and really coincidentally, my number 4 pick, Blithe Spirit, directed by David Lean from 1945, which a wonderfully...
Well, I guess we got that covered.
Yeah, a wonderfully funny film about a guy, Harrison, and his new wife, played by Constance Cummings, who end up being haunted by the ghost of Harrison's original wife, and it's sort of a weird domestic supernatural comedy about how annoying it would be if you were the new wife of a man whose old wife was now haunting the house. It's really funny wonderful. This is from sort of David Lean's period before he started making those epic movies like Bridge on the River Kwai and Lawrence of Arabia. And he was really well known for just the wonderful way in which he captured characters. And, you know, you mentioned Harrison, just a phenomenally funny guy at all times. And just, you know, if you want a guy to play the sort of upper crust British husband, you don't need to look any further than Harrison for your guy. And just, a wonderfully funny film.
Yeah, and David Lean really is good with the characters, and the nice thing about his later period with the epics and everything is he didn't lose that. He had these grand, epic scope-type stories and still concentrated on the characters very nicely. But Blythe Spirit, very, very good. All right, my number three, bit more traditional pick here, a bit more recent. It's called The Others from 2001, starring Nicole Kidman, and that's pretty much all I need to say to get me interested in it. I've talked about this a bit before, episode 5, I think. And the idea is this, there's a woman with two kids, the husband is off at war, and the kids have this peculiar allergy to sunlight that requires them to be inside, in the dark. I mean, what a great excuse to have a good ghost story going on at the same time, but it's done very well with a good attention to the characters and lots of creepy stuff going on there.
Yeah, I almost put this on my list, too. It's a good movie, and I like also the way that it really kind of feels like a lot of ways it takes its time period very seriously. I think there's a lot to be said for the way it's about the psychology of those who are at home during a war.
Yeah.
It's a modern film, but it seems like I think it captures that period pretty well. Well, I also have another recent movie for my number three. And, I think it's a really great movie. We've talked about it before, and it's The Sixth Sense from 1999 by M. Night Shyamalan. And I would be pretty surprised if it doesn't end up a little higher on your list, Sam. I think everybody is familiar with it. Bruce Willis and Haley Joel Osment as a kid who famously sees dead people. And I like it because it's not really a scary movie, though there are a couple of jump scenes. It's mainly just a suspenseful thriller, and it sort of really delves into how this kid deals with his gift or curse, whatever you want to call it, and just some great acting and a wonderful screenplay and incredibly well directed by Shyamalan. Even in the movies of his that I don't much care for, his later films, I think he has a real eye for wonderful visuals and great ways of framing shots and moving his camera around such that, you know, even conversation sequences become dynamic. And when he applies it to a really supernatural kind of thriller story like this, I mean, it really just heightens the suspense of every scene.
Yeah, it does. It's fantastic. And it is something to say. We have a thriller here, and some of the most engrossing scenes are simple conversations. I was pretty scared by this, actually. The scenes where he's increasingly encountering these ghosts, but before he knows really what they're all about, are pretty terrifying, I think. But, you know, it's not overbearingly so. It's a kind of movie you can enjoy as a thriller and not as a horror movie, if you get that difference. Okay, well, my number two is called The Uninvited from 1944. It's probably the definitive ghost story, certainly the definitive haunted house movie, and it's pretty clearly inspired by Rebecca. If you can imagine Rebecca with a supernatural angle to it, you have this gothic romance mystery where you have a lot of windswept bluffs and great estates and isolated areas and dark and trees and wind and that kind of thing. Stairways leading all over the place and darkened corridors and old house, just great old house with a lot of character. That's the kind of movie this is. And it stars Ray Milland, who is one of my favorite actors in that period, and especially in the kind of leading role where you have some kind of adventure and something that's unsettling. He seems to be really good at being grounded in that kind of situation.
Well, my number two is a movie that I love and I've mentioned before. In fact, my number two and my one are both flicks that I talked about back in our movies where what's scary is what you don't see list. But my number two is Don't Look Now from 1973 by Nicholas Roeg. Really strange, creepy exploration of death and not at all a traditional ghost movie. In fact, in some ways, the ghosts are a little more implied than even seen directly, and at the end of the film, it might be arguable whether or not there are any ghosts in the film, or whether something more deeply strange is occurring. But just a wonderful movie set in Venice, takes great advantage of its creepy, strange location, and a movie that if you haven't seen is really, really worth checking out. And it's not necessarily for everybody, but it really struck a chord with me, and I've just cherished it since I first saw it.
Yeah, again, if you can get around the ending. Well,
the ending's great.
Yeah, I don't know. Is this really a ghost story? Wonder as you go on, even before you get to the end, it's like, is it ghosts? Is it just visions? Is it just a psychological thing? Is it something else? And I don't know that the movie really answers that. But it does kind of feel like a ghost story, I guess. So I guess I can give you that. Well, my number one, of course, is The Sixth Sense. And you knew it was coming. And we've said, I think, all we need to about that. So back to you for your number one. I can't wait to hear it.
Well, talking about movies we've already said all we need to say about, what about The Shining, which is my number one from 1980 by Stanley Kubrick. I mean, how can I not pick it? I've already said how
much I loved it. Is that a ghost story, though? I don't know.
Again, arguable, but I think it is. I mean, certainly it takes advantage of the haunted house genre and what we think we know about haunted houses, and certainly it seems like there are ghosts in the film. You could argue about what it is exactly that Jack Nicholson's character is seeing, but what about his son and his experiences? I mean, if the twins aren't ghosts, I don't know what the heck they are. I know, I did think about it too. I thought, is this really a ghost story? Are there really ghosts in this movie? What's really going on? And the movie doesn't answer it, but then again, I mean, given how loose the definition of ghost is anyway, we don't really have any scientific criteria for determining whether or not something in a movie is a ghost or not. I think it counts.
Ghosting is when the something moves across the screen and the image behind it doesn't quite fade out properly.
This might have some ghosting in it then. I'm not sure.
Well, let's recap. My number six is Poltergeist from 1982. Number five, Dead of Night, the ghost story segment of it anyway, from 1945. Great movie. Number four, The Ghost and Mrs. Muir from 1947. And number three, The Others from 2001. Number two, The Uninvited from 1944. And number one, Ghost Dad, starring The Sixth Sense.
Man, I was totally going to make that Ghost Dad joke, but then I forgot, so... Good for you for picking that up. Anyway, my number six, also Poltergeist from 1982 by Hooper. Number five, Gore Verbinski's adaptation of The Ring from 2002. Number four, the other great Rex Harrison ghost comedy, Blithe Spirit from 1945, directed by David Lean. Number three, Shyamalan's The Sixth Sense from 1999. Number two, Don't Look Now from 1973 by Nicholas Roeg. And number one, Stanley Kubrick's Stephen King's The Shining from 1980.
And number zero, Ghost Dad.
Right, Ghost Dad. It's great. Just in the last week or so, I got around to watching an absolute classic movie that I hadn't seen and was just really struck by how wonderful it was. So I thought maybe I'd share it with everyone here. So I'm going to go ahead and spotlight the film Modern Times from 1936 by Charles Chaplin, which is just a really, really interesting movie in a lot of ways. To give you a bit of background about it, you know, of course, who Charlie Chaplin was. I hope if you're listening to this podcast, you know who Charlie Chaplin was, the great silent comedian, along with Buster Keaton, really one of the just masters at silent comedy. And he had a character that he used from the 1910s up through this film in 1936. And it was called, his name was, didn't really have a name, they just called him the Little Tramp or the Tramp. And he's just that, if you think of Charlie Chaplin, you're probably thinking of the way this character looked. He did play other characters, but Tramp was his most famous. And this is the last film with the Tramp. And so that's kind of an interesting thing about it. But it's also really interesting in the fact that it's a transitional picture in a lot of ways for Chaplin and for the movie industry. And it's one of the last Hollywood transitional pictures because so much of it is kind of silent. Now, there's a fully synchronized soundtrack the entire way through. I mean, this is 1936. We've talked before, the first, you know, major feature with sound was The Jazz Singer from 1927. So this is nearly a decade after sound was really introduced to Hollywood pictures. And it's also a follow-up to Chaplin's film City Lights, which is often considered his best film. A lot of critics would say City Lights is Chaplin's best movie. I like City Lights a lot. It's a great film. But, you know, I think I might actually prefer Modern Times a little bit. Maybe I should probably let it settle in my head a little more before I say that. But, I don't know, Modern Times is funnier, I think, throughout. City Lights is a little bit more of a kind of melodrama. And for my money, Chaplin gets a little too sentimental sometimes, and you know, Modern Times definitely has that same kind of sentimental core to it, but generally focuses more on being funny and comical, and it's hilarious. I mean, look, there is a scene in the movie, and I'm not making this up, I swear, there's a scene in the movie where Charlie Chaplin, in prison, accidentally gets high on blow and then beats up some guys. Which, I mean, that's funny anyway, but it's even funnier in 1936, in my opinion. It's also hilarious that they call it nose powder, I believe. Another felon who was in the slammer with Chaplin accidentally, he's trying to hide it from the guards, puts his cocaine in the salt shaker, and then Chaplin thinks it's salt and gets it all over himself, which, you know, leads to him being high and being able to foil an escape attempt. I mean, that's a funny scene, and there's lots of other very sort of, you know, almost modern-seeming humor to it. And I think that if you haven't seen a lot of silent movies, this would be a good one to start with, because it's not entirely silent. I'll get to that in just a second. But it definitely has a modern feeling about it. The story basically follows the tramp as he tries to get along in a really mechanized society, and it's called Modern Times, and it's really a statement about the 1930s, when, of course, America was sort of facing the Great Depression. And here's a movie about how workers have been reduced largely to sort of cogs on a factory assembly line. And there are a lot of gags that are just built around mechanical failures. Especially, there's one about a conveyor belt that's become a very, very famous gag. It inspired an episode of I Love Lucy. That's probably one of the most classic I Love Lucys ever, where Lucy and Ethel are at the chocolate factory, and they have to, I forget what they're doing, they're like putting chocolates in paper things or something like that, and as they keep doing it, the factory line keeps getting faster and faster and faster until they can't keep up with it anymore. Anyway, it's a gag that pretty much occurs when Chaplin plays this guy who tightens two bolts on these widgets that are coming out of this machine, and he keeps getting distracted and having to run back and get them all. And there's some funny gags where once the line stops and it's time for lunch, Chaplin's hands are still screwing things together with his wrenches because he can't get out of that mode. And, you know, that gag has sort of been a staple in comedy. An interesting little note about that, though, is it a very similar scene from a previous movie, a French film called A Nous la Liberté by René Clair. And the studio that owned the rights to that film was going to sue Chaplin over it because they thought it was plagiarism. Again, it's one of those sort of Hollywood stories where there's apparently some debate as to whether or not Chaplin had seen the movie prior to writing Modern, whatever, but the lawsuit was eventually dropped.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that is that neither filmmaker wanted to be involved. I mean, well, Chaplin obviously didn't want to get sued, but he and his staff, I guess, maintained that he hadn't seen the film. René Clair said, well, if he did, that would be an honor to me. I love Chaplin. He's great. I can only hope that my films inspire him. So it was a total thing between the studios and the kind of even the nations, maybe, kind of
right.
Just being annoying at each other.
The studio eventually did drop the lawsuit, though, when Chaplin said, you know, look, well, I don't know, maybe I have certainly borrowed. I owe a debt to Claire. And I guess that was enough for them, that restored their honor or whatever it was exactly. I don't think they probably would have won a suit there. I mean, that's kind of an obvious gag. I don't think you can really claim ownership of such an obvious idea. But the movie is also interesting. It's sort of a strong condemnation of the capitalism of the early 20th century. There's some stuff that, you know, suggests that the owners of these factories are really just exploiting people. And I don't want to make it sound like this is a really serious political movie, because it's certainly not. It's a comedy. There's lots of sight gags and other gags. But it does have something to say, which is going to be really common with Chaplin. All of his movies, I think, have something to say. And unfortunately, this movie was used as evidence of Chaplin's allegedly communist sympathies during the Red Scare Hollywood blacklist era. It eventually ended up with Chaplin just leaving the country in the late 40s, and he'd pretty much been done with movies by that point in time. Anyway, he kept making them increasingly infrequently, but he just, you know, said, fine, I'm just leaving. And it's pretty ridiculous to suggest that, you know, Chaplin was anywhere a traitor or anything, but I think in reality, too, this is not at all a communist movie. It does kind of satirize unions and that kind of stuff a little bit,
too. Industrial Revolution, it just kind of explores how people are changed by technology.
Right, and if anything, it's a condemnation of people who are cold and uncaring, and that's a theme that's always occurring in Chaplin's movies. Part of the reason the tramp is an interesting character is because he's a good-hearted person who, you know, maybe he'll look for an edge every now and then, but he's constantly shunned by society just on the kind of the way that he looks. They assume that he's up to no good just because he's dressed like this. But, I mean, there are some just hilarious gags, too. One of the funny things is Chaplin decides that it's better to be in prison than it would be to be out on the streets looking for work in this society where he can't fit in. So there's some hilarious bits where Chaplin's trying to get arrested. he just starts stealing stuff in plain view of the cops because that's going to be the best thing for him. So, I mean, definitely some satirical takes on the 1930s there. And probably most interesting from a film history perspective is the way the movie plays with sound. We've talked a bit about sound before, and I think if you're interested in more of that discussion, you should give this movie a watch. Now,
it's kind of a talkie and kind of not. Most of the movie does not have synchronized dialogue, though there is quite a bit of synchronized dialogue. The interesting thing is it only comes from mechanical devices. I mean, the scenes where Chaplin's working in the factory, the head of the factory has these video screens, basically, where he can, like, they're like kind of like giant video monitors where he can see people and talk to them, and they can talk to him or whatever, and anytime he's talking through that video phone system, you hear his words synchronized with what he's saying. We hear voices from radios, that kind of thing, but it's making a point. I mean, I think you could read a lot into it, and I'm sure people have, but here we only hear what people say when it's coming through devices. There's a mechanized salesman, basically. It's like these guys come in with this demonstration unit trying to sell to the head of the factory, and they just put on a record, and it's the mechanized salesman trying to sell this device that feeds people, which is absolutely hilarious when Chaplin gets hooked up to it, and of course it starts short-circuiting.
Oh, I love that one.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
Yeah, even the reasoning behind it is interesting. It's like, oh, we can get more work out of everybody right. if we build a machine to feed them lunch as they're working.
That way they don't have to take a break.
And I mean, you know, there's these levers that come by and wipe his mouth for him, as you know, he doesn't have to use his hands at all. That's a great joke.
Yeah, that's probably the best of the pure sight gags. My favorite gag from the movie is, like I mentioned, when he gets high on blow and beats some guys up. I think it's interesting the way our attitudes toward these kind of things shift around. I mean, these days, if you showed somebody even accidentally using drugs, I don't know that you what kind of certainly would be at least PG-13. Well, this movie's obviously going to be rated G if it were to come out today. Anyway, but you know, it also features title cards, because everyone else's dialogue, if they're not coming from a mechanical device, is on a title card. We never ever hear the tramp's voice speaking. We do, however, hear him at the very end. This is going to be the first time, I think, that Chaplin speaks in film. But it's not really speaking. He's singing a gibberish song. The tramp isn't going to speak English. He's going to sing this hilarious song in gibberish, which is going to be kind of similar to Chaplin's next film, The Great Dictator, where he's going to have his parody of Hitler kind of speak this gibberish German sound. But, yeah, we're going to hear that. And we're going to get also the very last title card in a Hollywood studio film. You can find, like, places where parodies and that kind of stuff use title cards past this point, but this is the last point where a title card is going to be used without it being self-conscious. So, you know, 1936 is really the end of that era. I mean, this is going to be nail in the coffin for it. So, interesting bit of trivia is that The Little Tramp has the very last title card in Hollywood history, the last true title card, which is kind of cool. And it's really interesting to see the way that we get both sound sequences and dialogue sequences together. One cool thing is that I was really struck while watching it, kind of thinking about this. Not every single action has sound associated with it. You know, there's lots of periods where people, like, set things down, where today a Foley artist would generate a sound effect. I mean, really, modern movies, when you watch them, virtually every sound effect that you hear that's not dialogue is done in post-production. They didn't actually capture that on set. You know, people walking through snow, people walking wherever. You know, that's why you hear everything so explicitly in movies today, is because they're all manufactured. But here you get lots of things where there aren't sounds where you would definitely expect to hear them today. It's interesting. It changes it. You know, it gives it a little bit more of a surreal mood, not quite as realistic, which I think is important for silent comedies, because they didn't quite play on the same realistic comedy that we have today. And it's also a very visually striking film. I think it's fair to say that this is Chaplin's most interesting film from a visual standpoint. For what's mainly a silent comedy, it's very ambitious looking. It's got a very sort of Metropolis feel to it, in that it has all these giant machines and all these images of workers in these long lines going into factories and these giant sort of cityscapes. And it's got kind of a sci-fi vibe to it, too. You know, I mentioned, like, video phones in 1936. That's pretty impressive. This is before television really exists, even. That must have been a kind of wondrous thing to imagine such a device existing. So, a really interesting-looking movie, too, with all these gigantic set pieces. And there's just this another great sequence where Chaplin gets sucked into the gears of this giant machine.
Yeah, I love that scene.
We see him going through it. I mean, it's so cool, too.
That's so visually evocative that is used a lot of times when if some documentary or something is talking about Chaplin, they'll cut to that shot among others, and to kind of sum up all his work in a nutshell. You know, it's just so visually evocative. You recognize that instantly as being something unique and classic.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a cool one. It's so funny, too. I think, you know, one thing is, it's really hard for me to make the case that this is a hilarious movie, because so much of it is visual, of course, because there's, you know, most of it doesn't have any synchronized sound dialogue. But I was just pretty much laughing the entire way through. There's a really, really wonderful sequence where Chaplin is a night watchman, and he gets this job as a night watchman at a department store. And so then he smuggles his girlfriend into the department store at night so that she can have some place to sleep and they can eat all the food. And just, it's one of those, it's one of those early sequences, you know, so many times you see, okay, people who are someplace abandoned, you know, we've seen like people in a mall or whatever just go and have fun using all the stuff, and this kind of thing where you see here, they just run to this giant department store taking advantage of it being closed. And there's this really great sequence where they're both on roller skates and Chaplin is roller skating around. And he's blindfolded, just kind of showing off. But there's this big, huge gap. They're like on the 10th floor of this department store. This big, huge gap where the workers have been working and stuff. And he doesn't know about it. So he keeps roller skating, coming right up to it, doing all these tricks and stunts. And, oh, man, the entire time, you're like, he keeps looking like he's about to fall into it. You keep waiting and waiting and waiting because he keeps getting closer and closer and closer. And it's this kind of long, drawn-out gag that's really hilarious and also kind of daring. You're like, it pretty much is one long take, and you're just constantly impressed by how wonderfully physical Chaplin was. This guy could just do so many amazing things with his body. I mean, so many of these silent comedians were just wonderful athletes. It's really a thrill to watch him.
And that's something we don't get today, is it?
No.
There's a character of silent comedy that I really miss, and that is the physicality of it. These people were really doing stunts like this, and to make them look funny, they had to get as close to the edge as possible and not go off. Once in a while, you know, they'd get hurt. Buster Keaton broke his neck, actually, when he pulled the lever on one of these water tanks by the train to put water in the steam engine. And he pulls on that, and the water cascades on him, and he falls down. And I think that was on purpose, but he wound up hitting the back of his neck on the train track. And
yeah,
that shot's in the movie, but he ended up breaking his neck.
He breaks his neck, stands up, and continues with the scene.
Right,
that's
right.
The amazing
continues
part.
Continues with the scene, and of course, he continued to do crazy stuff like that. Obviously, there's the famous thing with the building wall falling onto him, but he's okay because the open window was right where he was standing. There's all kinds of stuff like that. Chaplin did stuff like this too. Harold Lloyd. And the humor comes from the expectation of disaster. You say, something's bad's going to happen. And it goes right to the wire. And then everything is okay. So it's a kind of a sense of humor I miss. We don't really have that today. It's kind of unfortunate.
Yeah, and again, if all of our discussions about silent movies have at all intrigued you, I'll say this is a great place to start. I think this is a very, very accessible movie because it's one of those few that was made that late, 1936, that still is an absolute transitional film. Fascinating to watch and a whole lot of fun as well.
Earlier in the show, we had a trivia question about Charlie Chaplin, and it was, what was the only competitive Oscar that he ever won, and what was unusual about that? Steven, do you know?
I don't have a clue, man. Go ahead and tell me.
Well, take a guess on the category. That should be amusing.
Film score?
Oh, you're right. Yes, it was Best Original Score for the film Limelight. The 1952 movie, this is well into the sound era, and he shared that Oscar with a couple of the guys, Ray Rash and Larry Russell, who also worked on the score. But what's weird about the Oscar is that, okay, this movie was made and released in 1952, and actually, the movie itself is interesting because it stars Chaplin and Buster Keaton together. It's two great silent clowns appearing on screen for the only time. But the film wasn't released in Los Angeles until 1972, 20 years later, and under the Academy rules, that's when it was eligible. And so it won the Oscar in 1972 for a 20-year-old score. Kind of an interesting thing. And the previous year, he had won an honorary Oscar, and that was his second honorary Oscar. He won another one in the late 20s, so he did win other Oscars, but that was the only competitive one he ever won. That's it for episode 30, but check out our website, allmovietalk.com. You may not have heard about it before, but we have stuff all week long about movies where we basically take the podcast, move it to a different format, and carry on for another 6 days there to tide you over until we can come back in glorious audio. Also check out rinkworks.com, which is another good place to read about movie-related things and some other entertainment features as well.
Well, next week is a very special episode of All Movie Talk.
I hope we're not having a baby, because I'm not ready for that.
Yeah, that's a big commitment, Sam. We'll discuss that. But next week, we will be talking all about this upcoming summer movies. It'll be kind of another very conversational episode. We're not going to have most of our usual segments. Sam and I will be talking about what looks like the good, the bad, and the otherwise from this year's summer movies. Cut!
Oh, fooled you, I didn't say Simon Says.